All right, looks good. Okay, let's do the review thing. Since I'm a teacher, we're always about review. And let me just review the whole thing about the Yake for Intimacy, and then where we've been the last few weeks, and then we'll kind of press into a bit of a new thing. We've talked about, again, you did the Yake for Fame and Impact, Yake for Intimacy, and the next one's going to be the Yake for Beauty Strength. Beauty and Strength's kind of where I'm going to go next when I finish this one in a few weeks. Kind of give you where we're going to go. But again, intimacy or connection or bond, all of these cluster around the same kind of idea. It's the longing to know and to be known. And in that, there's a bond that forms in which we feel safe and alive. In other words, we unveil and we find ourselves celebrated. That's the ache for it. And we all just, you know, we are wired to long for this. And you know, pretty much the architecture of our lives, the structuring of our lives depends on how we answer this. And we will try to, we try to answer it in some way, we have to, or we try and silence it. So it is written into the fabric of our emotional DNA, this sort of longing to know and to be known. But again, I have to point out a couple of things about this working definition. This creates the dilemma because we long to be known, but most of us are terrified of it. Does everybody see the dilemma here? So this creates this push-pull in every relationship, from marriage to children to friends to parents. I mean, there's this push-pull. And if you peel away kind of how you operate on a day-to-day basis, in some measure, it has to do with that push-pull. I know that's very true in my life. Another thing about this definition, I have purposely not used the word love. If you notice that, even though love is so much a part of this, and I did that on purpose because the idea of love is so easily misconstrued, and it's one of those words that means everything, and so it means nothing. So in one sense, I took a bit of a risk to leave that out, but I think that's at least my reason for doing so, whether that's a good reason or not. I'm not sure. Okay, where have we gone? Just where we've been. We've looked at how teams, we sort of entered the idea of intimacy by looking at how teams of people sort of went in the process of doing something together, for example, a sport, or it could be anything, doing something together pulls out things in them, and they become together doing things, accomplishing things that they never could individually. And so we enter that sort of ache for intimacy and connection sort of that way. And then we talked about the idea of connecting with people as in terms of giving and telling of secrets. And that this is just a part of that intimacy. There's an unveiling. And with that, a sort of how that... that works. We usually tell our secrets when we feel safe enough to sort of dismantle the walls. And then we looked at intimacy and how it works inside of the family, how it's encouraged or blocked, or in some cases shattered. And we looked at how children get their first sense of what love and bonding and closeness is from their parents, and how parents can help be a help to that or a hindrance to that. And then finally, we looked at marital intimacy and how spouses can help each other in many ways with this, but I took the angle of how spouses can help re-image the shame in each other's lives, experience love through the eyes of others. In other words, what was the deepest reason for shame becomes the profoundest reason for being loved. It's a re-imaging of what was most shameful to us. So where do we go today? Well, we go to, let me just tell, just do a bit of storytelling this week, and then we'll, and again, I like to do this, just, I find that when I hear people's stories, it just helps me in ways I don't even have words for, so I try and do this here. I had the privilege this week of being both a spectator and a participant in this, how this sort of longing surfaced, and I'll just give you a few just general scenarios. I had a new group of men that began sort of a story group Monday night, and they each told a story that sort of marked them. marked them usually in a tragic way and became a defining moment for them. It was one of those moments where we all walked in. We didn't really know each other very well, but by the end of the evening, everybody had told a story like that, and you just look at them differently. I just felt very differently around them. And it was just like it was that moment where secrets had been told. Tuesday night, I have a group of young men that I lead, and we had been brought up the topic of marriage. And some of them are married, some of them are unmarried, and one's engaged, actually. And we each pulled out, I asked them, what's one of your questions about marriage, and what's one of your fears? Well, that went on for an hour. And I watched them, it was so interesting to watch the married speak to the unmarried, and the unmarried speak to the married. But again, it was that sense of these men were just sort of kind of letting down their guard and really talking about things that really matter to them. I watched it again on Thursday night with another group of men, and we were wrestling with the idea of the quest in our lives and what our fears are about actually launching out and doing what we think God is calling us to do, or just the stuck places we get in when we actually try to do that. And again, it was just, I just felt like a spectator, a privileged spectator, just sort of watching this. I was also aware of a number of interactions this week, and in my own life, teaching this, it's just, I've become so hyper aware of my own sort of persona in just dealing with people, and it's good places and in its fallen places. And one of the mantras that I've sort of say to myself now, it's sort of, I guess, code language for me that really helps me in terms of my intimacy with the Lord and intimacy with others. I say to myself internally, walls down. Walls down. It's something I say to myself, and it's a helpful picture for me when relating, and that has to, my own story is one of, from a very early age, walls up, because of my story, walls up. And I learned to operate with people very incredibly self-protective, but in such a way it protected myself where I was safe, but I was very isolated and in no way in which to really emotionally connect to people. Very, very difficult for me to. And one of the, it became really clear to me a number of years ago, I was reading out of Romans 8 where it says, nothing can separate you from the love of God in Jesus Christ. And I remember reading that and go, why do I always feel so separated from you then? And immediately the answer, I just went, it's not God, it's me. When I put all these walls up this way, what happens is I put them up this way. What we do in the horizontal realm radically affects what happens in the vertical realm. How we relate to others radically affects how we see God. And these things are just all interwoven together. And for me, the dismantling of the walls here has radically affected this, and this has radically affected this. So I tell all that just to say that it's sort of an ongoing pilgrimage for me in terms of this. It's just been kind of an incredible journey for me, kind of, walking through life, just thinking walls down, and just being able to be at points, not always, I fall and go back into old patterns, but just being present with people, just present. And it's just been a wonderful journey for me, and one that I'm still on. Okay. One more revelation. This is the obvious one. Just make a statement. It occurred to me recently that as I'm speaking about this, the ache for intimacy, it's not just in me, it's in everyone. And I've known that conceptually, obviously, for years. But in the last few months, I've felt it in others. You grow in the capacity to see that and then respond to that. Okay, so anyway, that's a little bit about me, a little storytelling. So let's go here and let's move into something else. I want to talk today about the two ditches of intimacy. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the two ditches, talk about what the road is between the two ditches, and then I couldn't find a movie. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a story. I know. I'm sorry, Gene. Yeah, I look forward to the movie so much. Maybe I'll have to come up with something. Now I'm struggling with fear of failure. I failed before my class. I'll read out of a story that has haunted me with this, and it's as good as I can get in terms of this, so maybe you'll understand. Okay, the two ditches. There's an old adage, every truth, there's two ditches. For every sort of the right path, there's sort of, you know, two errors. Usually opposite errors we can sort of fall into. And this is very true in terms of intimacy. Y'all, intimacy and connection is a mystery. In fact, all the great truths are mysteries. We can sort of rationally get close to them, and then after that it breaks out in a mystery. This is no more true than here. And at some point you kind of go, you can conceptualize and define it all you want to, but that's not the experience of it. Our words for it can only approach it. They aren't really it. But what's really helpful to stay in the mystery is to help define the errors here. And so I just want to pull up maybe next week I'll have some kind of little diagram, but let's think of an ongoing relationship like a marital one or a child-parent one, but it really, you could use anything, but those are two ongoing relationships. So ditch one is what I call disconnection, and it's the obvious one. We think about intimacy and closeness, this is pulling away. Instead of moving closer, we isolate, we withdraw. Emotionally, we shut down. We put the walls up. And then, you know, as it moves on, there's just sort of a complete leaving. And you think in terms of marriage, when you think of emotional divorces leading to physical divorces. With children and parents, when you think of children who rebel or flee, or parents who abandon or neglect their children. So everybody see that ditch? That's just, you just disconnect. Okay, there's another ditch. Now that's the obvious one. The other ditch is not so obvious, because it's not intimacy, it's absorption. It's not two selves mingling, it's one self or both literally losing themselves in the other. And there's clinical and technical terms people use for this, but I'm just going to use the word absorption. This is the opposite of disconnection. One or perhaps both in the relationship find themselves doing anything, even self-destructive things, to keep the relationship close and connected. And what do I mean by that? They try to control each other by doing anything to please the other person or to rescue the other person in a bad way. This leads to enmeshment and a growing loss of one's sense of self. You're so tied up in the other person in terms of either trying to get their attention, affection, whatever, that you literally lose sort of who you are in that person. The ability to truly love and care for the other evaporates because there's no self left to love out of. Do y'all see that? That has been lost in the enmeshment. Here we find marital partners connecting doesn't give strength and vibrancy. They sort of feed off each other. One person has put it in the worst of sort of, and you can find this in dating relationships, particularly when they're young, when the teenagers or otherwise, sort of two ticks feeding off each other. Have y'all ever heard that illustration? Okay, it's kind of a gross one, but it's sort of what happens in these relationships where there's this absorption pattern. And it is so destructive. You know, I always tell when we talk in the high school about dating relationships, I like it. When a guy and a girl, when they sort of, you know, they sort of fragment their relationships and they wall off all sorts of other relationships so they just spend time together with each other, the relationship's doomed. It can't manage. Because of that absorption pattern that's going on. Children, not only marital relationships, but children can feel violated here in an absorption pattern by a parent who seeks to dominate, control, or entangle them in their own emotional needs. And that's that sort of absorption pattern in the child and a parent. Okay, so if those are the two ditches, disconnection and absorption, then what is real intimacy? What's staying on the road? So that's where I want to go now. And my handy dandy, whoops, what did I do? Just when you think technology is, there it is. Okay, the two ditches of intimacy. Okay, here you go. Staying on the road to intimacy. So let's talk about this. What does it look like to stay on the road? Let me put some words to it, then let me read you a story. What does it look like? I think there must be an upright feeling of self, a sense of standing, is your own person that comes from the feeling of being treasured and loved. And out of that strong sense of self comes appropriate boundaries and accepted responsibility for choices made. But also out of that strong sense of self comes the ability to really love, to empathize, and to care for another person. We are able to truly love because we know what it feels like to be loved. In my language, the walls are down. We can see into each other. Okay, so that's you can sort of see that maybe with some why that's not disconnection and why that's not absorption. Can you kind of get a feel for that? But language here, again, we can describe it all you want to. I think it's really better to, again, go to story. So I'm going to go to this story. Lord of the Rings. So now what I'm going to read to you is not in the movie. So if you've seen the movie, this is why I have to read it out to you. It's not in there. They you know, left out a lot of things for all sorts of reasons, particularly the time reason. And this is in the first book. And where we are in the first book is that Frodo and the three hobbits have left, his friends have left to the Shire with the ring. They have little knowledge of the terrible danger they're in, and the only directions they have are from Gandalf, get yourself to Bree. And they have no idea what they've gotten themselves into. And along the way, trying to get themselves from the Shire to this little town called Bree, there are many obstacles they run into. And one of them is that they have to escape into the old haunted forest to get away from the Black Riders, the nine Black Riders. And here, they meet the strangest and most mysterious character in the whole book, I think. And it's the one that's left out in the movie. It's a man called Tom Bombadil and his wife, Goldberry. If you've read the book, and that probably triggers something inside of you in terms of memory. So they're in the four hobbits are in the old forest, and they get lost, trying to get to the river Withywindle. And they find, they get sort of seduced by the evil old man Willowtree, who is known for taking people and actually, you know, making them fall asleep, and then all of a sudden he, you know, closes in around them in terms of the bark and sort of just takes them down into the roots and eats them. So, how is this going to lead to intimacy, you're wondering? Well, here we go, it really does. They get in the clutches of the old man Willow, and all of a sudden, in the middle, two of them anyway, Merry and Pippin, and all of a sudden, you know, Sam and Frodo are just beside themselves. They're like, you know, they just start yelling, help, help. And all of a sudden they hear this man singing silly songs off in the distance. And they're just like, what? And I want to pick up the reading here. He comes and rescues Merry and Pippin. And let's just enjoy a little Tolkien. Tom burst out laughing. Well, my little fellow, said he, stooping so that he peered into their faces, you shall come home with me. The table is all laden with yellow cream, honeycomb, and white bread and butter. Goldberry is waiting. Time enough for questions around the supper table. You follow after me as quick as you are able. With that, he picked up his lilies, and then with a beckoning wave of his hand, went hopping and dancing along the path eastward, still singing loudly and nonsensically. Too surprised and too relieved to talk, the hobbits followed after him as fast as they could. But that was not fast enough. Tom soon disappeared in front of them, and the noise of his singing got fainter and further away. Suddenly, his voice came floating back to them in a loud halloo. And this is what he's singing. Hop along, my little friends, up the Withywindle. Tom's going on ahead, candles for to kindle. Down west sinks the sun, soon you will be groping. When the night shadows fall, then the door will open. Out of the window panes, light will twinkle yellow. Fear no alder black, heed no hoary willow. Fear neither root nor bow, Tom goes on before you. Hey ho, merry dole, we'll be waiting for you. After that, the hobbits heard no more. Almost at once, the sun seemed to sink into the trees behind them. They thought of the slanting light of the evening glintering on the Brandywine River, and the windows of Buckleberry beginning to gleam with hundreds of lights. Great shadows fell across them. Trunks and branches of trees hung dark and threatening over the path. White mist began to rise and curl on the surface of the river and stray about the roots of the trees upon its borders. Out of the very ground at their feet, a shadowy steam arose and mingled with the swiftly falling dusk. It became difficult to follow the path, and they were very tired. Their legs seemed leaden. Strange, furtive noises ran among the bushes and reeds on either side of them. And as they looked up to the pale sky, they caught sight of queer, gnarled, and knobbly faces that gloomed dark against the twilight and leered down at them from the high bank and the edges of the wood. They began to feel that all this country was unreal and that they were stumbling through an ominous dream that led to an awakening. Just as they felt their feet slowing down to a standstill, they noticed that the ground was gently rising. The water began to murmur. In the darkness, they caught the white glimmer of foam where the river flowed over a short fall. Then suddenly the trees came to an end and the mists were left behind. They stepped out from the forest and found a wide sweep of grass welling up before them. The river, now small and swift, was leaping merrily down to meet them, glinting here and there in the light of the stars which were already shining in the evening. The grass under their feet was smooth and short, as if it had been mown or shaven. The eaves of the forest behind were clipped and trimmed as a hedge. The path was now plain before them, well tended and bordered with stone. It wound up to the top of a grassy knoll, now gray under the pale, starry night. And there, still high above them on a further slope, they saw the twinkling lights of a house. Down again the path went, and then up again, up a long, smooth hillside of turf towards the light. Suddenly, a yellow, wide beam flowed out brightly from the door that was opened. There was Tom Bombadil's house before them, up, down, under hill. Behind it, a steep shoulder of land lay gray and bare. Beyond that, the dark shapes of the Barrowdown stalked away into the eastern night. They all hurried forward, hobbits and ponies. Already half their weariness and all their fears had fallen from them. "Hey, come Merrydoll," rolled out the song to greet them. "Hey, come Derrydoll, hop along, my hearties. Hobbits, ponies all, we are fond of parties. Now let the fun begin, let us sing together." Then another clear voice, as young and as ancient as spring, like the song of a glad water, flowing down into the night from a bright morning in the hills, came falling like silver to meet them. "And let the song begin, let us sing together, of stars, moon, sun and mist, rain and cloudy weather, light on the budding leaf, dew on the feather, wind on the open hill, bells on the heather, reeds by the shady pool, lilies on the water, old Tom Bombadil and the river daughter." And with that song, the hobbits stood upon the threshold, and a golden light was all about them. They stepped over the wide stone threshold and stood still blinking. They were in a long, low room filled with the light of lamps swinging from the beams of the roof. And on the table of a dark, polished wood stood many candles, tall and yellow, burning brightly. In a chair, at the far side of the room facing the outer door, sat a woman. Her long, yellow hair rippled down her shoulders, shot with silver like beads of dew, and her belt was gold, shaped like a chain of flag lilies set with the pale blue eyes of forget-me-nots. About her feet in wide vessels of green and brown earthenware, white water lilies were floating, so she seemed to be enthroned in the midst of a pool. "Enter, good guest," she said. And as she spoke, they knew that it was her clear voice they had heard singing. They came a few timid steps further into the room and began to bow low, feeling strangely surprised and awkward, like folk that, knocking at a cottage door to beg for a drink of water, have been answered by a fair young elf queen clad in living flowers. But before they could say anything, she sprang lightly up and over the lily bowls and ran laughing towards them. And as she ran, her gown rustled softly like the wind in the flowing borders of a river. "Come, dear folk," she said, taking Frodo by the hand. "Laugh and be merry. I am Goldberry, daughter of the river." Then lightly she passed them, and closing the door, she turned her back to it, and her white arms spread out across it. "Let us shut out the night, For you are still afraid, perhaps, of mist and tree shadows and deep water and untamed things. Fear nothing, for tonight you are under the roof of Tom Bombadil." The hobbits looked at her in wonder, and she looked at each of them and smiled. "Fair Lady Goldberry," said Frodo at last, feeling his heart moved with a joy that he did not understand. He stood, as he had at times stood, enchanted by fair elven voices. But the spell that was now laid upon him was different. Less keen and lofty was the delight, but deeper and nearer to mortal heart, marvelous and yet not strange. "Fair Lady Goldberry," he said again, "now the joy that was hidden in the songs we heard is made plain to me. O slender as a willow wand, O clearer than clear water, O reed by the living pool, fair river daughter, O springtime and summertime and spring again after, O wind on the waterfall and the leaves' laughter." Suddenly he stopped and stammered, overcome with surprise to hear himself saying such things. But Goldberry laughed. "Welcome," she said. "I had not heard that folk of the Shire were so sweet-tongued. But I see you are an elf friend. The light in your eyes and the ring in your voice tells it. This is a merry meeting. Sit down and wait for the master of the house. He will not be long. He is tending your tired beasts." The hobbits sat down gladly in low, rush-seated chairs while Goldberry busied herself about the table, and their eyes followed her, for the slender grace of her movement filled them with quiet delight. From somewhere behind the house came the sound of singing. Every now and again they caught among many a merry dole and a merry dole and a ring-a-ding-dillo, repeated words, "Old Tom Bombadil is a merry fellow. Bright blue his jacket is, and his boots are yellow." "Fair lady," said Frodo again after a while, "tell me, if my asking doesn't seem foolish, who is Tom Bombadil?" "He is," said Lady Goldberry, staying her swift movements and smiling. Frodo looked at her questioningly. "He is, as you have seen him," she said in answer to his look. "He is the master of wood, water, and hill." "Then all this strange land belongs to him?" "No, indeed," she answered, and her smile faded. "That would indeed be a burden," she added in a low voice as if to herself. "The trees and the grasses and all things growing or living in the land belong each to themselves. Tom Bombadil is the master. No one has ever caught old Tom walking in the forest, wading in the water, leaping on the hilltops under light and shadow. He has no fear. Tom Bombadil is master." Now, I want to reflect just a minute on this, and then I want to read just one more short paragraph to finish. Let me reflect about this. This is the magical realm of Tom and Goldberry. Notice the enchanted beauty of Goldberry. She receives the water lilies that Tom has brought for her, and she looks and feels like a queen. And Frodo, all of this affects Frodo's heart. He sees her beauty sparkle and radiate, and he finds himself singing. And notice the respect and love she has for Tom. She feels his presence and strength as a man and calls him master of wood, water, and hill. And then she says four words in all of his silly singing that is really the measure of who he is. "He has no fear." What is that like? Also notice how Tom delights in Goldberry. He rescues the hobbits from the old man Willa, but that was just an interruption. He was out gathering, lilies for her. He's intent on getting home before dark, presenting his gift of water lilies. Here we find a man and a woman who radiate strength and beauty in such a way that are just enthralling to these four hobbits, and then to the readers. For me, when I read something like this, I find myself pulled in and drawn towards something that I can only describe as holy. I'm no Tolkien scholar, but if Tolkien ever wanted to depict a man and a woman in an unfallen state, I think this is probably as close as he got. The real beauty of their intimacy, however, is portrayed in a simple paragraph a few pages later. Let me just read this. "They've stayed at the house one night, and it's been a rainy day the next day, and so Tom has told them many, many stories all day long." And at the end of this, I just want to read this paragraph about what happens. Lady Goldberry comes in. "The rain has ended, and new waters are running downhill under the stars. Let us laugh and be glad. And let us have food and drink," cried Tom. "Long tails are thirsty, and long listenings hungry work, morning, noon, and evening. With that, he jumped out of his chair and with a bound took a candle from the chimney shelf and lit it in the flame that Goldberry held. Then he danced about the table. Suddenly, he hopped through the door and disappeared. Quickly, he returned bearing a large and laden tray. Then Tom and Goldberry set the table, and the hobbits sat half in wonder and half in laughter. So fair was the grace of Goldberry, and so merry and odd the caperings of Tom. Yet in some fashion they seemed to weave a single dance. Neither hindering the other, in and out of the room, and round about the table, and with great speed food and vessels were lights, and lights were set in order. The boards blazed with candles white and yellow. Tom bowed to his guests. "Supper is ready," said Goldberry. And now the hobbit saw that she was clothed all in silver with a white girdle, and her shoes were like fish's mail. But Tom was all in clean blue, blue as rain-washed forget-me-nots, and he had green stockings. It's the dance. Did you catch that? They move in each other's lives, enhancing the other without hindering the other. And I think the reason why, when I read this, it haunts me is because here I don't see an echo of intimacy or hear it. I hear the real thing. I don't just see a reflection of intimacy. I'm peering into the real thing. Now, realistically, y'all, what does this have to do with real life? Come on. I mean, I know that's kind of the question I tend to run to sometimes too quickly. What does a fairy tale have to do with our daily lives? Here's the deal. It's not in their correspondence to our lives. It's in their difference. That's where we need the help. For our hearts, I know my heart, is awakened here by what should have been or what ought to be and even what can be. Even as Frodo and the three hobbits found their hearts awakened, we find ourselves wooed and refreshed by this type of escape from a real world that is lying to us, causing us to despair, and corrupting us. We need an escape from this. We need an escape to a place where our aches are not mocked or cursed or both. Here, in fairy tale, we find our aches nourished and drawn out. And even though we may not know what to do with the arousal or the awakening, I certainly sense, something momentous here, even if it's a faint whisper. I feel that when I read about the intimacy between Tom and Goldberry. Their lives portray what only the word I know is an iridescence. It's a radiance. It's an unfettered joy. I believe that when we start living in Christ, that moves us towards this momentous whisper. I stop to imagine my life with intimacy with people, my life with Heidi. What would I be like, my life with my two kids? What would I be like if I sang silly songs? What would I be like if I lived unafraid and as shrewd as Tom was? Could we keep moving towards each other so that our lives could become a dance, moving in and out, hindering each other, not hindering each other, but rather enhancing each other? See, this is the type of imaging and dreaming we need to do. Because I believe this dream doesn't just exist in our imaginations. I believe this dream is going to come true one day. You know? And maybe we'll enter that dream we call heaven and find it's better than any dream we imagined here. Okay, let's stop. Let's go here. And here's what I want to do. I want to start with the last question first, and then we'll pull up any of the others. But out of all the things that I've talked about today, either just talking about the ache for intimacy that comes up, the two ditches, or trying to portray the mystery of intimacy, using the story here and the dance, what has been the most important thing said so far this morning to you? And hopefully some important things are going to be said here too. Let me turn this off first.